This is an RNZ podcast. Nō mai whakarongo mai ki te ao tai whenua. Welcome to Country Life. I'm Carol Stiles.
And I'm Duncan Smith. On the show today, we have another in our series of small settlements with fewer than 500 people. Today, it's Nightcaps.
We hear about a Massey trial involving the wool-shedding Wiltshire sheep.
And we're with a couple of young market gardeners who've made some major changes to their business since Cosmo was last there.
But first, he's with Ag Research Chief Executive Dr. Sue Bidrose to find out about the Crown Research Institute and what her work entails.
We do science, so that's what we do. And we do science quite specifically to assist our agri-food, agriculture and agri-technology industries become more profitable, improve their environmental footprint and improve the social well-being of people who work in those sectors.
How big is Ag Research and where does the funding come from?
Yeah, we've got four campuses, Ruakura, Hamilton, Grasslands and Palmerston North, here at Lincoln, just in the outskirts of Christchurch, and Invermay, just outside Dunedin. We spend about $150 million a year. Of that, about a third comes straight from government to support this kind of science. About a third comes from industry and about a third from other sources, including contestable funding for grants. And we run, obviously, a series of farms that also run at a profit sometimes when we're not doing research on them. So that's our kind of mix. We've got about 750 people who are engaged, and of those, about 550 are specifically doing science for the agricultural sector. And I often, you know, as I find out some of the science that we're doing and I get such a kick out of it, I think, why don't my mum and dad know about this? You know, it's so easy just to sound off at farming for, you know, messing up the waterways. But the huge amount of time and effort and research and funding that's going in from farmers and from the government to actually reduce nitrate emissions, to reduce methane emissions, I do wish that it was, you know, that it was, there was an easy way to get that message out.
Yes. And you started last year?
Yeah, August, late July, August.
What were the first challenges you faced?
Well, we were in COVID times, so we'd had some research that had become problematic because of COVID, and the government had generously stepped in to assist us financially. But financially, we've been challenged for some years. We've been struggling to break even. You know, the sector has to pay for a chunk of this research, and when a sector's struggling a bit, then the funding struggles a bit as well. But we're just putting forward budgets that do show break even and a return to profitability, so that we can invest in our own science, so we're not beholden on other people to have to go cap in hand begging for science funding. And as we get into that space, that will be a nice position to be in. We'll be able to be clearer about the science we do that we fund ourselves because we see long term it's good for the country rather than because someone else will fund it.
So over the next few years, what are your main goals and objectives for ag research?
You know, with COVID, agriculture has risen back up to the top of being number one New Zealand income earner. And it's very easy to pretend that, and you hear it sometimes, that, you know, agriculture is yesterday's industry, and it's really not. It is critical to New Zealand. And ensuring that we produce world-leading research from our world-leading scientists that ensure that we are making the planet a healthier place to be in for our children and our grandchildren, seeing more and more of that come out of us and seeing that the uptake of that by on-farm increase, those are my dreams. They're the things that I think ag research is here for. And watching our scientists' enthusiasm for that is heartwarming.
How many projects are currently underway, roughly, and are there any projects that you have a particular interest in?
You know, in the IT system, we've been going through all of our projects and trying to work out how we categorise them, because there's tiny through to multi-year, multi-million. I think we've got about something like 500 projects underway. And a lot of those, of course, are with our partner, Crown Research Institute. So we share a lot of real interest with Manaaki Whenua, who look after the quality of our land and our water, with Plant and Food, who do the cropping end of the agricultural sector. So between us all, there's a lot of work going underway. Some of the stuff that I really like I've enjoyed being taken around the greenhouses and shown some of the stuff we're doing in biodiversity, some of the stuff we're doing in weeds. Hard to get excited about weeds, and yet you meet with these very excitable scientists. There's some amazing stuff going on around emissions, which really does fire up my passions. You know, methane chambers to measure cow belching, and what can you do to reduce that? Vaccine work. So if you vaccinate, if you've got something you can give young calves that means they will emit lower emissions for the rest of their lives, if you can develop stuff like that, you're really on a winner, so that we can hold our head high internationally and not feel like we have to have less cows or less income as a country, but actually we can make the environment cleaner with what we're doing and still enable New Zealand to be prosperous.
Mm. And what does your role involve? What do you do on a day-to-day basis as CEO?
I do a lot of corporate stuff, so, you know, making sure that as an organisation we can pay the bills and we've got the right policies in place. Today I've had a meeting about how do we as an organisation look after our staff if the Alpine fault ruptures and there's a 8.4 quake on the west coast. What do we need to do to make sure staff can access food and water and wash their clothes? What science do I need to make sure continues to go ahead, because it's critical for New Zealand's future? So I do those kind of things. I spend a bit of time in Wellington, where we run out of the Ministry for Business and Innovation. You know, they're the ones who make decisions about where science funding goes, and it's important they know the stuff that's going on that really could make a difference. And the other government departments, MPI, Primary Industries, critical partner for us. So I do a lot of that. But as much as I can, I get out and I see the science and I hear about how broccoli plants talk to each other, and I get very warmed by that. That's the exciting end, and I never get enough time to do that. I spend far too much time with policies and not enough time with science.
AgResearch Chief Executive Sue Bidrose.
And now to our look at conditions across the Motu. Parts of Northland have had lots of rain. The east coast outside Whangarei received about 215 millimetres over 3 days up to Monday. The west coast got a lot less, more like 20 millimetres. The rain was very well received, and with warm temperatures, there should be grass growth. Mid-season calving cows will get a chance to be priority fed. It may be too late to really help out the early calvers. Now's a good time for dairy farmers to take a break to recharge energy for the season ahead. The Pukekohe district had about 14 millimetres of rain over the weekend, with further light showers, little wind and mild temperatures, growths continuing unchecked. Early sowings of onions have now germinated.
Ground conditions are quite firm in Waikato, and there's still grass growth. Thursday hit 22 degrees. Cow conditions good and pasture covers are well above average. Farmers are spending on riparian planting and upgrading effluent systems, but there's still confusion around the Climate Change Commission report, because while reducing stock numbers appears to help emission targets, fewer cows will eat more, and therefore their individual emissions will go up. Bay of Plenty avocado growers have had a record breaker of a season. Sales in the 2020-21 season totaled 227 million, up 72 million on the season before. Exports were worth $167 million and volumes were up 10%. The Australian market went particularly well. Just over half the fruit was grown in Bay of Plenty. The rest is mainly grown in Northland. On the kiwifruit scene, some packhouses have all their fruit inside now, but others will continue picking through next week. And like other exporters, Zespri is having challenges with shipping. Fruit is still leaving the port of Tauranga, but schedules are slower than normal because of container issues.
King Country has turned warm again. After last week's frosts and fog, pastures are now almost greening up again and putting farms on a good footing for the rest of winter. Our contact was actually at a bull sale in Masterton when we called, and he said a Speckle Park bull sold for $16,000. Not bad. Nature has continued to be as kind as it could be in Taranaki. Temperatures have been warm. The farmer we caught up with is busy planning a farmer's trip to outback Queensland for the end of August. He thought it was good for people to take a break. They'll visit large cattle stations, camp on some of them, and meet the farmers.
The Whanganui region has had little rain and ground conditions are great. Grass is growing with 10 degree soil temperatures. Some dairy farmers are milking on into winter to take advantage of the high milk price. There are real stock water shortage issues on farms in the Napier-Taihape Road, but otherwise there's been a kind start to winter. On the east coast, there's been some steady rain and the weather's still mild, so grass growth should kick along a bit in the next week.
Some sizeable apple developments are going in near Waipawa in Hawke's Bay. One of the developments is 140 hectares. It's a strange time for the apple sector. Overseas markets want our fruit, they're prepared to pay for it. But the major limiting factor affecting investment decisions is worrying about where the harvest labour will come from. A few years ago, water was limiting investments, now it's labour. Meanwhile, apple trees are nearly leaf-free, pruning is well underway, apple pack houses are still going flat out with double shifts. They stay busy until the end of July. Finding containers and ships to get product offshore is a major headache. It's been a pretty good week in Wairarapa. There was one foggy morning with misty rain, but it's still relatively dry. Grass on runoff farms is in short supply because the rain never came earlier in the season. Soil temperatures are still warm enough for some farmers to be applying fertiliser. Stock condition on our contacts farm is average to OK, but certainly not flash. Showers passed through Horo Whenua this week and left overcast days behind. Temperatures are cooling.
Across Cook Strait, and apple growers in Nelson and Motueka are moving into pruning now that harvesting is done and dusted. A grower says his team of RSE workers have been amazing. He feels for them, though. They came for 6 months but are still here after 18. He says some of their partners in Tonga have had babies that they've not yet met. In the orchard, 55% of his apple crop was lost to hail this season. He says if they hadn't been hit by the hailstorm, he would have lost 20% anyway because there weren't enough people available to do the picking. Soil moisture levels are up after Marlborough got up to 70 millimetres of rain last week. Farmers are feeling a bit more positive, but more rain is needed, especially on the east coast. Stock are doing okay despite the overall dry autumn conditions. Scanning's down 3-9% on last year due to the ewes being on the light side going to the ram. Pruning's underway in vineyards, but because of the shortage of pruners, more machines are being used to do stripping and mulching.
A massive clean-up and repair job is underway across Canterbury post-flood. Digger operators are working 7 days a week for their farming clients. Volunteers are mobilising from all over and getting out on farm. The help being provided is very much appreciated by the farmers. It'll take months to get on top of all the work that needs to be done. Areas that were extremely dry, in particular Banks Peninsula, now have a green tinge. Milk tankers on the west coast did their last official pick-up on Wednesday. A farmer near Barrytown says it's the end of an average season. His main job now is moving brake fences, general maintenance work, and looking at fixing or replacing older farm assets.
South Otago farmers welcomed the tail end of the rainstorms that slammed Canterbury last week. The ground is still dry, though, after what has been a very dry autumn. With little mud underfoot, pasture utilisation has been excellent. A farmer at Balclutha says his cattle are on fodder beet while the ewes are getting topped up with baleage and swedes. A farmer at Edendale in Southland dried off his cows last Friday. He was going to do it earlier that week, but it was wet and he thought that it was better for them to continue milking rather than put them on muddy paddocks of crops. He's now busy getting half the herd ready to go to winter grazing and fixing fences that were damaged after a heavy rain at the end of last month caused the Matoura River to flood part of his property.
This is Country Life on RNZ National 101 FM.
Now we're heading to a Massey University farm near Masterton, where scientists are studying a sheep breed which naturally sheds its wool. Rural reporter Maya Burry has the story.
Behind Trump! Behind Trump!
This mob of sheep on Massey University's Riverside Farm isn't being rounded up for shearing. In fact, it's hoped in the future the sheep won't need to be shorn at all. They're part of a multi-year flock study. Scientists are monitoring the sheep as they're crossbred from woolly Romneys to 100% self-shedding Wiltshires. Massey University's Steve Morris says the research aims to give farmers a better idea of the costs and benefits of moving out of the wool business.
We've had contact with farmers who have continually said the wool price is getting low for crossbred wool, shearing costs are going up. It's costing farmers to shear. And we had thought, well, you either go with higher value wool, and the simplest at the moment is Merino crossbred, or Merino in the 20 to 28 microns, but that's difficult in North Island Hill Country where it's wet. Difficult in the South Island places where it's wet as well. So the other option was a fully shedding sheep, and that's where this project with the Wiltshire came about. There are farmers out there who are trying to breed Wiltshire sheep, you know, crossbreed, they're doing it. But what some farmers come to us and say is, what are the production losses in terms of number of lambs, in terms of live weight gain, in terms of carcass weight, as we go through the grading up process from the first cross to the second cross to the third cross and the fourth cross? Well, we hope to be able to quantify all of those production changes.
For Riverside Farm's manager, the Wiltshires are something new.
Digby Lowe is my name.
And how long have you been in this gig?
Only 12 months, so I've spent most of my working life up in the hills, so this is a bit different for me. Really, really enjoying it, yeah. Come off managing a place a little bit bigger, like 25,000 stock units, so a little bit different to here.
Yeah. How many stock do you have on farm here?
Probably about 5,000 stock units, so it's a little bit different.
But different challenges, I guess, as well, because you're working with researchers and scientists, and they have different objectives, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's all pretty interesting stuff, and yeah, it's a lot of stuff I've always sort of wondered about a little bit, so yeah, no, it's really interesting.
Have you ever worked with this breed before?
No, I haven't.
And how would you describe?
Well, the thing is, for me too, I've always been a real advocate of wool. Been in my 50s, I've sort of been brought up with the wool industry, and it seems, you know, this is quite different, and so it's kind of interesting, but I found them pretty good. A little bit touchy to handle to start with as lambs. Once they've been worked a bit with the heading dogs, corners are taken off them, they seem to handle pretty good. Yeah, I mean, so far we haven't really seen any shedding. It's only the first cross, so, you know, we haven't got wool lying around the paddocks or anything like that. So one thing about the rams is, they were shedding earlier on. There was wool everywhere, and I did make the mistake of thinking I'll just get them in and shed that little bit to tidy them up because it looked a bit scruffy, but they're big buggers, and it was an ideal. No.
One of Digby's daughters, Grace, is a shepherd on Riverside Farm. She's enjoying working with the Massey University team and her dad to learn more about the breed.
So I work alongside my father, who's the manager. I take care of sort of the recording and everything of the animal health, and he do a little bit of stock work, but we both work together pretty well. He's not very good on the computer side of things, so I take care of a lot of that. It's really nice working with Massey because we, it's such nice support, like working with Steve. He's such a lovely, or they're all so nice, and all the researchers are so lovely. So everything to do with the Wiltshires has been really cool. They grow really well, which is definitely, they grow out really well. And they have, you know, slightly different personalities. I think they're quite clever. They seem like very clever sheep.
Because obviously this is a research trial, is there any sort of special things that you have to do to make sure that, you know, the study has its integrity maintained?
Yeah, so we have a small mob of Romneys that get run alongside these, and they get everything done exactly the same as these. And so they, at Massey, they all compare all the numbers, basically. Weight gain, fertility, when their scanning percentage, you know, just everything. In general, dirtiness, as I said before, with needing to be dagged. We weighed the Wiltshires, we weighed all of their fleeces and compared that with the Romney fleeces.
One farmer already sold on making the shift to Wiltshires is Wairarapa farmer Robin Murray.
This year we decided to put part of our flock to Wiltshire Rams. We've done about 50% of our stock, basically, have gone to the Wiltshire Ram this year, and we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, how many ewes is that?
About 1,300 of our ewes went to Wiltshire Ram.
So that's a pretty pretty big decision, isn't it?
It is, yeah. We've obviously been producing wool for a long time. It's really, the change is driven by lack of return for wool, the amount of labour required to generate that no return, and The fact that I'm not getting any younger as well, we're hoping that we'll be able to make a change which will improve our animal management and animal welfare without having to put all the work in that's associated with conventional four-walled sheep.
I hope it goes well. And are you guys excited about the...
Oh, yes, we're really looking forward to seeing what happens, but we aren't expecting too rapid a change. Obviously, we're going to have quite a few lambs on the ground this year, which first cross, but sometime really before we reach the full benefit from the change process we've started.
Robin Murray ending that item from Maya Burry.
Spring Collective started in 2017 after Dominique Shakira, Logan Kerr and Penny Sewell pooled their resources, leased an 8-hectare block in Leeston and started a cooperatively run organic market garden. Cosmo caught up with them at the time, but more recently, Dominique and Logan decided to set up their own larger veggie growing business. When Cosmo was in Leeston recently, he popped in for an update.
Quite a lot has changed in the last 4 years. We've become Streamside Organics. So we're still farming on some of the same land and some new land. We farm on about 60 acres. And we've actually got a stream, hence our name, Streamside Organics,
yes,
that runs for, was it 1.5 kilometres along the boundary? And we're looking at regenerating that into native bush.
When I was here last, you were leasing the land, but now you own it?
Yeah, so yeah, just in the last year, we've finally been able to purchase our own block of land, which has kind of given us the freedom to do what we want on the land, which is really, really good. We have not a short-term lease anymore. We can look for the future, and we can develop the land the way we want to and look ahead more than just a few years with a short-term lease, looking ahead more into 10, 15, 20 years down the track.
Yes. Was that challenging, negotiating the cost for the land?
Oh, definitely. Yes, it's been a long struggle and battle trying to come up with enough to get the deposit for the land. Not from a farming background, yeah, it's been a lot of work.
Yes, yes. Dominique, did you have a wee celebration when you actually signed along the dotted lines?
We did, but it was also a little bit delayed because we weren't able to move. Well, we were leasing the land, so we already were on the land, but we weren't actually able to move into the house until about 4 months later. So it was sort of quite a drawn-out process, and we're getting a little bit impatient.
Oh, so the land came with the house as well?
Yes, so we live on farm now.
Fantastic. And you've built a new processing shed.
Yep, that's integral for the running of our farm. So we've put up a four-bay shed, and that's where we process all the vegetables, wash the vegetables, and send them out to their destinations.
So it's been quite an investment.
Yeah, for sure, definitely. Massive investment. Yeah, biggest investment I've made so far in life.
But exciting, I guess.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, definitely. Well, just going back to, like, having a block that's your own and the vision for your land going forward, we can put things in the ground that take longer to establish. So this coming season, we're putting in a few thousand strawberry plants, raspberries and other kinds of berries as well. More perennial plants, things that, you know, take a little bit longer. And also next season we're going to be putting in some asparagus, which takes, you know, 3 or 4 years to get established. And also helps fill the hunger gap that we have here, and, well, I guess everywhere in New Zealand, but mainly further south, is that we struggle to get vegetables growing, or a good amount of vegetables growing before Christmas. And those kind of crops, like the asparagus and the strawberries, raspberries, will be helping fill that gap.
Yeah.
And keeping us busy and keeping our staff busy as well during those months harvesting these things.
So having that security, yeah, allows us to really develop our business in ways that we weren't able to in the past. And to go back slightly,
yes.
Logan's a man of a lot of talents, so he was the driving force behind putting up the shed and a lot of the development on the land. So that's really helped us get ahead too, just him knowing how to do a lot of things.
Do you find that you spend more than the average 40-hour week here working on the farm?
Definitely, yep, definitely. Even more so now we live on site. We used to commute from Christchurch to our farm, but now we live on the farm. That 40 hours is looking a lot more, close to 80.
How about you, Dominique?
I am doing a lot of hours, but I've put a few boundaries in place and cut back a little bit. So I do get home before it's dark, whereas Logan gets home when it's dark.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, what are the vegetables that we are standing beside right now?
This is red chard and silver beet. And then further, you can see fennel, leeks, kale, beetroot, cabbages, cauliflowers, broccoli, Chinese cabbages. Yeah, it's amazing. You know, only, I'd say 8 months ago, this was just pasture, and now it's all in vegetable production.
Have you had any issues this year with pests or weeds or anything like that?
Always. There's always issues with pests and weeds, but this year, pest problems have been less, apart from white butterfly. Like, we've had much less problems with aphids and other insects. Disease problems have been maybe a little bit higher this year. They have been just later in the season. I think it's because of how warm it has been up until really now, the last week we started having frosts. I think that's the issue. We had a lot of disease pressure coming into autumn. Yeah. So rust on leeks and just other kinds of mildew and sclerotinia on lettuces and that kind of thing. And one big pest is what we've struggled with is psyllid on our tomato and our potato crops this year. So we cover all of our potato crops with a mesh, like a microclimber cloth. And in the past, it's done a really good job. But this year, we've covered them, covered the whole season, and the psyllid's still been able to get in there.
Moving into winter, what's the plan? What's going into the ground?
I've been spending maybe the last sort of couple of months just after crops have come up, putting cover crops back into the ground, just a combination of different species, rye corn, vetch, tick beans, and lupins this year. Yeah.
Do you use irrigation?
Oh, yeah, definitely. We wouldn't have anything growing here this season in particular if we didn't have the irrigation.
And where does the water come from?
It comes from a well. We have a bore just at the boundary of our property.
Without the well, you probably wouldn't have been as interested in the land.
No, we wouldn't. We found a lot of promising-looking land around, but with no water access, and so it was just a no-go for us because we need water. And, you know, we're always working on improving our soil quality and management, increasing the water-holding capacity in the soil. But because we are growing annual vegetables, there's a requirement for needing water, especially after transplanting, getting the roots established, when they're about to head up and so on.
Yes. Have you changed the way you grow vegetables since I was last here? Are you using different techniques now?
Yes. Yep, we have changed the way we've grown vegetables a bit. As we've grown, we've managed to get new implements or new tools that make things more efficient and easier. One of them is, it's more for harvesting, but one of them is a carrot lifter. So we used to go out there with a shovel and hand dig all the carrots. Now we've got a bar that we can drag behind the tractor under the ground, and it just lifts them up so that we don't have to hand dig each individual bunch.
That would save so much time.
It definitely saves a lot of time, and it saves everyone's backs.
I noticed behind the processing shed there, you've got some people cleaning vegetables. How many people do you employ here?
We employ 14 people. That includes some part-timers, some people who manage the markets and help us out there. And we've got about 8-9 full-time staff on the farm who are out here every day harvesting vegetables, weeding, packing, washing produce. And wages is about 50% of our turnover goes through into wages. It's a very manually intensive area. And we're also lucky or privileged to be able to pay the living wage and want to always be able to give back as much as we can to our employees. Yeah.
Are you making a good profit? Are you doing okay financially?
Yes, we get by. I don't know if there's a huge profit in this industry. But there's a good demand for organic produce, and we've just managed to scale up to meet that. So we do two farmers markets, the Christchurch Farmers Market and Opawa Farmers Market. We're still selling direct to supermarkets, about half a dozen New Worlds around Christchurch, a couple Raywood Fresh, sell to some restaurants, and we do subscription-based veggie boxes and sort of custom-ordered veggie boxes where people can pick and choose, a bit like a farmers market stand, but online, pick and choose what they put in the box and get that sent out.
That's a good idea.
every week. Yep. One of our employees actually developed the software for our website to enable that to function. So we're pretty grateful for that because there's not much software around, you know, geared for that sort of thing in New Zealand.
Dominique Shakira. Cosmo was also talking with Logan Kerr from Streamside Organics in Leeston.
Hi, my name is Seamus Callanan and you're listening to Country Life on RNZ National.
We have another in our Under 500 series now, where we visit communities with fewer than 500 people to talk to some of the locals about the place they call home. Today we're in Southland, visiting Nightcaps in the foothills of the Takatimu Mountains, almost an hour's drive northwest of Invercargill.
Supposedly when first people came here, they camped for the night and when they woke up in the morning, they had a look at the Takatimu Mountains and they said, oh, look, they've got their nightcaps on because they were covered in... That is the local myth, whether it's true, not true, who knows?
Nightcaps is a town built on coal. Māori knew of coal outcrops in the district, and in 1880, the Nightcaps Coal Company began exploratory work. Miners and those supporting the industry arrived, and the town was born. In 1970, 737 people lived in Nightcaps. Now it's less than half of that. When my grandfather walked more than 11 kilometres each way to Nightcaps School in 1910, up to 300 children attended. Today, 5 buses bring most of the 81 children on the roll.
So the beginning of the day and the end of the day is full on as we check everyone as they come in and out.
The school is now known as Takatimu Primary School, and Heather Boniface is the principal.
Look at that, in a T-shirt, and there's snow on the hill.
They are very resilient. Real country kids. So, for example, I think you'll appreciate this, on Friday there's been a request for our annual camo day. So the house groups have organised a day around duck shooting, complete with duck calling. So, very much a student voice and student led with the ideas. So there's always something happening.
How cold does it get here in winter?
The school is, you know, can be closed due to snow, and we can get down to -4. Yeah, we're a resilient bunch, though. We're up for it.
And you... Whoops, there's a tractor going down the street.
Yes, tractors regularly going past. We've had a pony drop by to drop off a notice. Our annual pet day is a fabulous event. Very much a rural school.
What comes to pet day?
Oh, more like what doesn't come. Ponies, we've had rats, we have had cats, all types of farm animals. Fabulous day, indoor crafts and exhibits. Bean growing competitions.
Beans,
yes. Very much a community event.
Kyle is dropping off his daughter. There's no longer a school in his town, 7 kilometres away.
I live in Ojai, and I bring my daughter over every day.
Ojai. Why did you move to Ojai?
I was just sick and tired of the rat race up in Auckland. I just had enough. And then a year later, I told my dad about it, and he said, well, sounds great, and he moved down. We bought a house up at Ojai.
What's the community like?
Awesome, absolutely awesome. The whole of the South Island is great.
Now, if you don't mind me asking, what did you pay for your house?
My father paid $90,000 for it. It's an old shop which has been converted into a kindergarten, and then it was converted into a house. Turned 100 last year.
Has it got insulation and good heating?
It does have a really good fireplace. That's what I'm paying a lot of money for, is firewood at the moment. But no, it's a beautiful area to live in.
Shirley Dobby works in the school office. She's a local through and through. Shirley was born in Nightcaps.
The thing now is more the fact that there's not a lot of what I call local, like young parents with young kids. It's now we're more reliant on dairy farmers. like when my kids were here, there was so many kids that used to play what we called in the middle, which was near the fire brigade, kicking balls and stuff, whereas now you could probably count the amount of kids that live in Ojai nightcaps on your hands. And yes, so now it's mostly dairy farmers.
What do you like about the place?
I just love living here. It's in the country. Can't be bothered with town stuff, the hustle and bustle. I mean, yes, I have to travel in there every now and again, but I just love the country, just the space and the people. You get to know the people, and people look out for people. People who are sick, the elderly, people will check on them. Through COVID as well, it was just amazing with our fire brigade. Like Ojai nightcaps, they were going round. They had set up through the community worker like these forms, a pink form that you could put up, just a piece of paper, if you needed someone to talk to. You left up a green one if everything was okay.
And just they put it in your window?
Yeah, and they just drove past every day. They had rosters.
And if you put up a pink form, what would
they
happen?
Came and they just sort of knocked on the door but stood back. Because I did ask someone that, and they said that they did have a wee few, not many, like really, but just probably maybe lonely or needed something. So they would just stand back and sort of talk to them for a bit. Or if they needed to take them, say, to a doctor or something, then they would. The Ojai Nightcaps Fire Brigade were amazing. That's what you love about a small community. People care about each other.
What's happening in the school today?
Oh, okay, all go Shay. Wednesdays we have tamariki coming over from St Patrick's, our neighbouring school for tech. So our tech teacher, they are busy making charcuterie boards today. Last term was a healthy eating focus, so I sampled an awful lot of muesli bars until we got to a really good prototype, we thought. At present, there are a lot of things happening in the school. We're about to have a new tech block, which is super fantastic, so we envisage that will be used by our community. We really see this as a community school.
How many classrooms do you have?
Okay, now that's a really, really interesting point. It's a very, very large school and grounds because it was an area school.
So you've got room for growth?
Absolutely. Everyone welcome.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
To get to the garage, what do I do?
Well, you're not going to get lost. If you turn right, go straight ahead, and you'll see the garage right there on the corner.
I've arranged to meet retired miner Bruce Allen. He spent his working life at the Linton Mine at Ojai, just down the road.
Hello.
Good morning.
Bruce.
That's right.
Carol Stiles.
My nickname's Carter.
Oh, Carter. Yeah. People call you Carter.
Well, that was always the thing in this whole district here with underground mining, you see.
Yeah?
Everybody had a nickname because, you know, when I was started at the mine, there was 400 there, underground, in the dark, and everybody just had a light on. There was no use singing out, Hello, John, because there were six Johns within Kooi and all had lights on. So if you rung out, my best friend was called Tussock. So when you yelled out Tussock, you seen a light out of five or six. You seen this one light flick around, you knew he was there.
Who gave you the name Carter?
Oh, a good friend of mine, Walter Goldsmith, I think it came back. He used to play halfback for a rugby team.
And he just decided that you would be Carter?
Mm. He was called Goldfinger.
How old were you when you went down the mine?
16. I was actually 4 days off 16. You weren't allowed down underground till you were 16, but we were short of labour in those days. We had 41 years underground.
Can you remember your first day?
I can clearly. Excited and a bit frightened.
Oh, I bet.
To get on, you know, we used to get a ride down at Linton Mine. There probably would have been 100 men on the trolleys. Used to get a ride down on a wire rope. Used to lower us down on these trolleys down there. A mile and a quarter to the bottom, and I happened to be right at the bottom.
So there's still a mine here at Nightcaps?
That's just where that truck turned the corner there. Just go up there about a kilometre and a half past the old nursing home where I was born, and that's the open cast mine, Nightcaps here. Just up here, a mile, there was underground here, and it went behind us over here on the flat over here, there was underground mines. A couple of bad underground accidents, deaths involved, a couple of explosions, but I think that's in every mining community just about in New Zealand. You know, there's been accidents, but...
When was that?
I'm just guessing. I'd say it would have been around the 1920s.
When did the underground mine close in Nightcaps?
Approximately, I'd say, 1940.
So the hotel is still open here?
It's still open certain days of the week, I think it's open, and bistro and gaming and that. Well, I mean, I can remember in the early days going in that hotel, and Campbell Mason was proprietor. I remember being there one afternoon, and he and the fire siren rang, and he was on the fire brigade. And he just jumped out over the bar and out, and he said, "Help yourselves, I'll be back when the fire, we find out what's wrong," he says. But that was the loyalty and faith he had in the community here, and that's what the community was like. Unreal. I think around the 70s I was president of the rugby club here, and we had 7 or 8 played for Southland out of that local team, and I can remember them, the Cargwans used to come out here pretty cocky sometimes, and just up the road here is the football paddock, and they brought their flash teams out, the Blues from Invercargill and that, and this team here on a lot of occasions could knock them over by 50 points. But the crowds that were here, you know, there'd be 3,000, 4,000 people here on a Saturday afternoon to watch a Blues game like that.
I saw a for sale sign on a house just down the road. How much do you have to pay for a house in Nightcaps?
Oh, well, they've increased dramatically. Like, not so long ago, they sold houses here in Nightcaps for $1. A good house here now could hit $200,000, $250,000, but the wooden bungalow houses here still getting, they've raised up now $60,000 to $80,000, but you've got to travel to find a job, that's all.
Well, how did a house sell for $1? What happened?
Oh, I think people just got scared of coming here. There was houses empty here with the redundancies. There was houses here, just people just walked out of the house, just offered a job somewhere and just walked away, couldn't sell it.
That was people being made redundant from the mine?
Mainly that reason, yes. Without jobs here, we're gone, you know. Nightcaps was closed for years. They've only just recently started open cast again.
How long ago?
Been open for 20 years now, I suppose.
I was told no visit to Nightcaps would be complete without meeting community stalwart Bev Evans.
Yeah, just down past that, where that white car's pulling in there, see the brake light on her? That's where Bev is there.
Okay. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Hello, how are you? Good. I've got my boots on. Are you sure they're clean? It's nice
through.
And warm in here. Look at the snow this morning.
That's just natural for here. I love it when it's there, but I just, you know, can stay there, that's fine.
Do you get much snow down here sometimes?
Not especially. We probably get one good fall at least a year.
Yeah.
Which takes all the bugs away.
How long have you been in Nightcaps?
All my life. The whole 30 years. 77 years.
You would have seen a lot of changes?
Yes. Not always good. Yeah. But happy to say in the last 3 or 4 years, we have people coming into the town, picking up cheaper houses and doing them up beautifully. And I feel Nightcaps is now on its way up again.
What do those people who come to town do for jobs?
I would say the greater percentage are retired, and most of them are Aucklanders. So we do have something in Southland. We have really good, substantial homes that can be done up, you know. And they're bought cheaply, they're done up beautifully, and they retire happily.
Well, you have a beautiful view and a lovely section, don't you? You've got the Takatimu Range as a backdrop.
Yeah, I think we're very lucky.
And a garden. What grows here? What veggies grow here?
Oh, all veggies. Carrots, parsnips, beetroot, onions. Everything grows here. Yeah. Potatoes especially. You don't have to buy. We grow enough to bag them for the whole year.
You've been involved in the community. What sort of things have you done over the years? Go on.
Well, I probably started off about 15 in the basketball club it was then, not netball, and I was secretary treasurer of that. Then I moved on to play centre when my children were born. I was a member of the golf club for 40 years and went through all the positions in the golf club. I've been in victim support. I've been a volunteer ambulance officer, chair of the local medical board up here. And for the last 27 years, I've been involved in local government.
What else should I know about Nightcaps?
I think we do well for a small town. We've got a good rugby club, good squash club. We've still got a golf club and a bowling club. It's a lovely place to live in. It's peaceful, it's friendly. And from my own personal experience in the last few months, people are immensely kind and helpful.
Linda. Hello. I'm Carol. I'm in the Foursquare, Nightcaps Foursquare.
Yes, you are, yep.
And you're Nightcaps born and bred?
Yes, I am, yep, yep. I live right here, in the back of the shop, me and my husband, and we have a house at Riverton that we travel to on the weekends just for a getaway.
You're a Foursquare, but you also have, what, sandwiches and coffee?
Yep, we make our own sandwiches.
Your takeaways?
We're takeaways.
You've got bluff oysters.
We have got bluff oysters. We're very lucky to have bluff oysters, actually, at the moment. Yeah, weather's been bad.
Now, who shops here?
Okay, so we have, obviously, all of our locals, which are very good to us. We have the transport company around the road. They've got 35 trucks, so they're our locals as well. We have the coal mines in their breaks. We have Nightcaps Contracting, Very Hungry Boys. We have all dairy farmers on the outskirts of us, and we have sheep farmers. We have the truck drivers coming to and fro the coal mines, Ojai and Nightcaps. And basically, we've had lots of tourists since COVID, so lots of camper vans calling in. And also the Heritage Trail, we have lots of walkers come off that and do their shopping for their overnight stay at Birchwood Station. And yeah, so it's, yeah, we're very busy actually.
What's the Nightcaps community like?
Friendly, like we have lots of volunteers. We've got the Fire Brigade, we have the Rugby Club who help all the youngies out trying to get them into rugby games and, you know, into wee teams, all the wee ripper rugbies and just trying to keep the community together.
There's a little medical centre here.
Yes, so we have a medical centre that runs 2 half-days a week and the nurse is there 3 days a week. I'm on the board myself of trustees, so it's all, yeah, so we're all volunteers. Keeps us very busy.
Lovely. Thank you very much.
No worries.
Very good. And the sun's coming out.
It is. It's going to be a lovely day.
It's
still quite cold. Yep. But sun's out, that's always good.
Nightcaps Contracting has its depot around the corner. Its owner, Tony Philpott, says there's plenty of work on.
Very, very busy. We do agricultural work, civil work, roading, forestry roading, work for Environment Southland, coal mining and farming.
Nightcaps is a coal mining town, so I know everyone's against coal mining at the moment, but we love it.
Are farms being developed around the place, or is it just maintenance work mainly on farms?
Just maintenance work now. It's just too hard for farmers to get consents in that nowadays, so they just tend to go, oh, bugger it, I'll spend the money on something else.
Why are you based in Nightcaps?
Why am I based in Nightcaps? Nightcaps is a great place to live. It's a very small town. I think there's only 300 to 500 of us. 300, I think, 350. What a lot of people wouldn't know is there's over 120 people start work in Nightcaps every morning. That's one interesting fact of Nightcaps.
What do they do?
Well, they work for us. They work for the local transport services. They've got a huge staff. They're doing very well. And they work for the Nightcaps mine. Those three companies would be the main employer, but there's over 120 staff turn up to work every morning, so it's not bad for a wee town, is it? In saying that, it's very hard to get staff out to Nightcaps because it's a small town, but they just don't realise all the positives that it's got.
You're also involved in the Fire Brigade?
Yes, yep. 27 years I've done in that, in the Fire Brigade. Yep, made it up to the chief now, so been the chief for the last year. And
do you get many call-outs?
Not as many as we used to get. Smoke alarms have made a huge difference to us. Cut our work down, that's for sure.
Car accidents?
Car accidents, yes, a lot of car accidents, yep. You never get used to them.
I've been told that the Fire Brigade did some really good work during COVID.
Yes, we did. Well, we were worried about the community and a lot of people just wanted someone to talk to. So each morning and night, we're on a roster system and one of the brigade members would drive around the town and if there was a pink slip-up, you stopped and had a look, if it was green, gave them a wave and carry on. So we did that for, must have been close to 2 months because we carried on after COVID. Yeah, so it was a lot of work, but I think it just brought the community together a bit more. People thought, well, people do care.
Did you speak to somebody who'd put a pink slip up?
Yes, but funnily enough, that was it wasn't really a pink slip. We got a call about a kitten stuck, so I had to go and get a kitten out. But the rest was all just helping the elderly, you know, get firewood in. Or it was mainly elderly people that just weren't too sure about what was going on, you know, and just wanted some reassurance.
I've heard you've had a few people move to town.
Yes, there's been a lot of people move to town, and everyone that moves to town loves it. I'd just like to see Nightcap sort of restored to the Nightcaps of 30 years ago. That's wishful thinking, but with the amount of people coming back and houses getting tidied up, I think there's a good chance that it might happen.
Tony Philpott from Nightcaps. You also heard from Linda Sutherland, Bev Evans, Heather Boniface, Bruce Carter Allen and Shirley Dobby.
And Carter mentioned miners' nicknames. Apparently, it wasn't uncommon for people to only find out the real name of some men when they married or at their funerals.
That's great. Well, that's it for this week. We'll be back same time, same place next week. Have a great weekend. Bye now.
Bye now.